Welcome back to Positively Trek, everybody. I am one of your hosts, Dan Gunther, and with me, as always, is the wonderful, the bespectacled, the terrific, so many more adjectives, Barry DeFord. Barry, how's it going today?
I'm fantastically well, and I'm happy to be here to be talking more Strange New Worlds. It's been quite the season so far.
It has been, yeah. So we are smack dab in the middle of Star Trek Strange New Worlds Season 3, finally. And we are talking about Episode 3 today, Shuttle to Kenfori. So last week, of course, we got the double header of the season premiere and the second episode. So those of you out there, if you only watched one episode last week, you got another one to watch there. Yeah. You don't miss that. This week we're on Episode 3. And, jumping right into it, last week we talked about how the style shift, the tonal shift from episode 1 to episode 2 is like popping a clutch and really jarring, and especially the fact that they both dropped on the same night. But definitely keeping that up with episode 3 here, we have the, high action, fast paced, fairly dark premiere, then the rather light Wedding Bell Blues, and then now we're back into the darkness with Klingons and other stuff we're going to talk about this week.
I would agree, and actually I was thinking about this when we last spoke, when I was kind of shutting down my computer after our chat. I was like, if these three episodes were like food, like say you were going for like a several course meal, they start you off with lasagna. The next course is candy. And then now this one is like, we're going to have some Doritos with melted cheese on it. I mean, all of these things are good, like pick your candy. I don't know. There's so many people with different tastes. I was thinking Sour Patch Kids. For whatever reason, it just feels like lasagna, Sour Patch Kids, and now we're having Doritos with lasagna. It really does remind me, weed is legal in Canada, and I feel like someone would take to that very well. I'm not a partaker myself, but I would imagine that's kind of the direction you'd want to go in, or like a teenage diet, right? Where you're going to have, macaroni, Pop-Tarts, and then some cold pizza or something like that, just a little eclectic, I guess you could say. But this one, I would definitely refer to as a snack of an episode. It didn't land as well, actually, as the other two for me, but that's not a criticism. This is the episodic nature of Strange New Worlds that I'm really here for. It's a side quest, and I really enjoy the side quest element of this episode and some of the intrigue it includes. So, yeah, I'm excited to get into this one.
All right, yeah. And I think, like the premiere episode this season, there's a lot of stuff going on. Like, it's one of those ones that it feels like, oh, it's pretty straightforward, but when you dig into it, there's some A and B plots, and there's a bunch of stuff happening. We're getting our crew kind of separated again, similar to episode 1, and there's a lot to talk about. So let's see how these Doritos with melted cheese on them turned out here.
Cool Ranch.
So we start with the impetus for why they're going to this planet Kenfori, and this is the ongoing story of Captain Batel and her condition, which I think when we were first introduced to what was going on with her in episode 1, and they came up with this solution. An old school Star Trek thing would be like, yay, we solved it. Cool. She's better now. And I like that they're not doing that. They're kind of really exploring her condition and doing some things with it that, I think you alluded to when we talked about it before, maybe exploring what it's like to, live with a chronic ailment or a terminal ailment, possibly, given how close we find out she is in this episode to losing that battle ultimately. And it's this ongoing story that I wasn't necessarily expecting to be an ongoing story. Mm-hmm. The question with the season finale last season was, will Captain Batel be okay or not? And that turns out to be a much more complicated question than just that binary.
I would agree fully. And this hits a little close to home for me. I have a family member who is actually living with a terminal illness. I say living with because I refuse to say dying of, because you can you spend a lot more time dead than you do alive. So I'm not going to deal with that side of the thing. But Pike's behavior, and that's kind of why I did that allusion. Pike's behavior is very reminiscent to that family's caregiver, the person who is taking care of my terminally ill family member. They will stop at nothing to find a way to prolong, keep comfortable, and just add that quality to life for that individual, kind of moving into these different steps and phases. And I mean, we don't know what Battelle's final situation is going to be in all of this, but I think the exploration is good, and I feel like, again, it does what Star Trek does so well, is it takes something that we might be experiencing in our lives, in our kind of spheres, and puts that science fiction take on it, right? The exploration of humanity is actually what's happening with Star Trek, and I think I think that's what drives Pike, and you know, doing something recklessly to kind of manage a trauma is, again, also something that comes up a fair bit in this episode. So I do appreciate, you're right, you know, though I call it, you know, it's episodic in its nature, there are some continuities that lace between the episodic storytelling in this that I think lend itself well. They've really blended that concurrent or contiguous episodic balance very, very well. So yeah, I'm interested to see how far Pike's willing to go.
Definitely. There's a lot about Pike that I think I'm going to want to talk about, especially later with this episode, and kind of the mystique that's built around him, and some things that this episode might have to say about that, which and I think this figures into it as well, his reaction to what's going on with Marie, with Captain Battelle. There's some interesting stuff at play there for sure. So this episode, the plot entails them going to this planet Kenfori, where and this felt a little tenuous at the beginning for me. There's this plant that's rumored to have these effects that can help Captain Battelle. And in retrospect, once you watch the episode and you rewatch this beginning part, you realize they're intentionally very much downplaying what the danger to Captain Battelle is right now, because they're kind of actively hiding that from Pike. So it kind of, to me, just taking that information at the start, it's like, oh, there's this planet that's in contested space. You're not allowed to go there. And it's rumored to maybe help with the situation. Why are we doing this? Let's maybe try and find something that's a little bit more concrete, a little bit more accessible. Well, we find out later there is nothing else. This is the Hail Mary, right? Like, yeah. She is going to die in 24 hours, basically, yeah, if they don't do this. Which, again, like, they seem to be kind of hiding from Pike, but he's also so determined to help her that he will do this even based on that limited information.
It also brings up sort of an idea that you sometimes not knowing the stakes of an aspect of a situation can actually change your behavior when you're handling it. And I think that that's kind of what we might be looking at here. Like, I have gone through events in my life where, looking back, I was like, oh, I was in a lot more danger than I thought. But I think knowing, if I knew I was in as much danger, I might have actually caused myself to become in even more danger, or even be harmed in some way, shape, or form. So sometimes that ignorance is bliss definitely works. But this is also a Hail Mary throw. And I do have to say that there's a certain recklessness to the entire premise of this episode that, again, we need to talk about. And moving forward, there's some more recklessness that takes place that I think finally gets addressed in a very meaningful way. And and I think you and I both were very happy to see that. So, you know, the idea of also, I think, you know, what this predicates itself on is, this is a really nice kind of like check the dipstick of the post-Federation Klingon War. and what things are looking like, how tensions are currently at, or where tensions are currently at, and what is happening on the frontier between Klingon and Federation space.
Mm-hmm. And very much setting up the kind of Cold War that we're going to see between the Federation and the Klingons throughout TOS, which briefly breaks out into another hot war that takes place over one episode in season one of TOS. But, you know, and then really continues up through the TOS films, right? This is really kind of, we hear about the ideological differences and the clash of civilizations between the Federation and the Klingons. And this is where it all gets set up, this and the war in Star Trek Discovery for sure. And yeah, seeing that dynamic where there's a Klingon lurking behind every asteroid and there's forbidden zones that you can't go in because they're contested. To me, one of the interesting things was this whole outpost and everything that has happened there. It was a flourishing Federation research colony. They were researching these plants. They were making these grandiose goals for scientific discovery. There was this grain they were going to develop that could, you know, basically solve galactic hunger. But because of this war, they've had to abandon this place and it's gone to seed. Like it's overgrown and there's some other dangers that have cropped up due to what's going on there as well, which we will get to. But it's interesting kind of as a metaphor for the disruption and the upending of norms and basic living that war does, that you know, flipping the table, declaring war and trying to kill other people just completely decimates and destroys good things in the world.
Yeah, full agreement. I mean, I think probably for me the most, you know, the closest analog, I guess you could say, to where they're basically going would be the space between the Republic of Korea and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So Absolutely. In our parlance, South and North Korea, right? That whole area in the middle is overgrown. It's there's a lot of useful things in that space in between that you just can't really access anymore, mainly because it's too dangerous. Both sides have wired it for destruction should any of the two sides even take a step in either of those areas, and it's tightly monitored, it's hotly contested. And you know, think about how that's disrupted both the society and the economies of both respective republics, right? This is one people, you know, in this case with Korea, you know, using that, this is one people. I know Earth and, you know, the Federation, sorry, and Klingons are different, but we find later, obviously by TNG, they're not so different. There are similarities. There are things that they can work with. And I mean, I actually want to watch The Undiscovered Country with you again soon. I watched a retrospective on it recently and, I think it's fascinating. There's a lot of Western-centric ideals that kind of come into it, right? Like the Klingons were far more brutish than the Soviets by any stretch of the imagination. But that doesn't necessarily take away from the reasons why there's so much tension. And I think that tension is typically caused, if you use Korea again as an example, just how brutal that war was. The peace is going to have a certain kind of latent undercurrent of brutality to it. Mm-hmm. And I think we really see that here.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Star Trek VI as well. The music in this episode, very evocative of Star Trek VI, which is not a bad thing. I love the score for Star Trek VI, and I love the score for this episode. So,
no purple blood, though.
No purple blood. No, maybe black blood. I don't know.
Kind of looked a little more black. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
it depends on who was bleeding too, and what condition they were in.
Yeah,
yeah. We're burying the lead here quite a bit, aren't we?
Yeah, we'll get there for sure. So, yeah, they're going to this planet Kenfori. They take a shuttle. It's supposed to be Spock and M'Benga, but Pike, of course, insists that he goes along with him. And they land here. They pretty quickly find this bloom that they're supposed to use, but they soon discover that the Klingons have followed them there. A Klingon shuttle has landed. And they're very quickly come under attack by this Klingon strike force, it seems. Mm-hmm. So, interesting Starfleet tactics as well, I notice. You know, the Klingons are firing at them, and they're firing back from undercover, and then the Klingons seem to disappear, so M'Benga gets up and walks out into the middle of the room and then is captured, because the Klingons have sneakily hid behind something.
Right? Yeah, I do have to say, the Klingons' approach is far more effective, right? Like, they see the Federation shuttle. They don't make an announcement. They don't say anything. They just open fire and destroy it immediately. And I think that's...
You think they know we're here? They know we're here. Yeah.
it's good. And yeah, like, they just come in guns a-blazing. And I guess to some degree, they're correct to do that. There was a violation of the treaty, like, right there, you know, mm-hmm. like, you are now, you are fair game, pal. And I'm, you know, not knowing the eventual premise for the reason why they're there in the first place, I would say even if they were just a you know, some kind of sentry out there, yeah, they were well within their rights to attack and take these Federation folk prisoner, because what are you doing here?
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that they're violating this treaty to do this is interesting. There's a line later in the episode, and I just, like, I kept meaning to bring it up when we were watching it, but they're talking about sneaking the Enterprise to the planet to rescue them later on. And basically they're saying, like, well, we have to go this speed so that we don't get detected. And Ortegas has a different plan. And number one says something like, how about a plan that doesn't violate a treaty? And I'm like, actually, these plans all violate the treaty. You're just talking about getting caught or not. Which, yeah. I was like, was that a slip? Was like that her mentality? Like, if we don't get caught, we're not violating the treaty.
Well, it's only illegal if you get caught.
Right? And that doesn't sound very Starfleet.
That doesn't sound very holding society together either. I mean, like, you and I had a really interesting conversation, and I mean, most people are going to roll their eyes at this, but speed limits, right? Mm-hmm. You know, are you, your dad said to you, are you a English teacher? Or do you have, you know, a Bachelor of Education major in English? Yes. What does maximum mean?
Right? It's printed on every sign, maximum, yeah. And then a speed, right?
Yeah.
At least in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I guess that's the thing is, like, yeah, when she says that, it is kind of like, well, you're already in for a penny, in for a pound there, dude. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that might just come down to not lazy, but efficiencies in script writing.
Yeah, a bit of shorthand there. But
yeah, yeah, you've already violated so many aspects of this treaty. So, but again, what are you willing to do for someone who's sick? What are you willing? Like, this is very kind of flies in the face of the needs of the many as well. Like, let's risk the entire Enterprise crew so that one captain can get a Hail Mary throw medicine.
And it's kind of interesting that now two out of three episodes of this season so far have basically had a line somewhere along the lines of, this mission is unauthorized, so we don't have to report what we're doing here or whatever. It's like, gee, you do that a lot.
Yeah. Getting a little bit of Voyager vibes. At least they were in the Delta Quadrant, right? They were very far away from headquarters. Yeah. In this case, not so much. I mean, actually, I would say even Janeway might blush at some of the things they're doing.
It might be, you know, we always said Kirk was a bit of a maverick with this stuff. Maybe it's the Enterprise. We got to look at the common denominator here. It's it's that chip. It affects people somehow.
It does.
Or Spock. Yeah. It's all Spock.
You're above the law. One last thing I want to say, and this is just kind of like, you know, when we think about the state of the planet, you talked about sort of like the flora. And I mean, this planet is basically all flora, very little fauna, kind of. I think about how infrastructure suffers. My other example would have been the war in Ukraine that's happening right now. And there are other situations happening. Obviously, genocide in Gaza is still going on. There's still a crisis in Myanmar. But just to focus on Ukraine really quickly, NATO recently supplied a lot of the Ukrainian troops with irradiated bullets, which... were used in the Iraq War with deleterious effects, a lot of cancer and everything like that. And you think those bullets that get fired, if they don't hit people, they land in the ground. And Ukraine is known for its soil. It is known for, you know, all the food that they make. And if you have irradiated bullets in that soil, that's going to have knock-on effects for millennia, right? It takes a long time for the half-life of something radioactive to come down. And I think we are sort of seeing the short-term, you know, this was more of a lab. It wasn't something bad. I guess I could also use Chernobyl, which was in Ukraine as well, but under different circumstances. I just think that this episode could have also maybe explored a little more, and maybe it will in the series, just how war doesn't really end when treaties are signed, right? There are still farmers in France and Belgium who get blown up by unexploded World War I ordnance. Mm-hmm. So again, I really do think that you know, I would consider anyone who died in this episode to be a casualty of the actual Federation Klingon War still, because this is definitely an effect from it.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. And I mean, having visited Cambodia, if you want to see knock-on effects of wars, and oh god, if you didn't hate the people behind that before, visit Cambodia and spend a couple days talking to people and learning about what was done to that part of the world. And yeah, absolutely. It's something that I feel like jumped out to me in this episode, but wasn't necessarily front and center in the story. And I think maybe could have used driving that point home a little bit more, that this wasn't just like a crazy weird adventure that, you know, there's some complications. It's a direct result of that war and and the legacy that it leaves behind, for sure. Yeah. Well, speaking of legacies left behind, we could go a couple of ways here. There's a story with Mbenga that has carried on since season two. And the first episode that dealt with this, Under the Cloak of War, which I think was like the third last episode of season two, something like that.
Great episode.
Great episode. Left me very unsettled by the end of it, as it was very much meant to. We have that ambiguous scene, and it was shot in a very ambiguous manner with Ambassador Dokra and Mbenga. And we don't see what actually happens. We only have what Mbenga says happened, which is that the ambassador came at him with a weapon and Mbenga defended himself. And in that ensuing conflict, Ambassador Dokra ended up dead. And of course, they had this huge history. Dokra was not a good person, committed horrific war crimes. And Mbenga had feelings and personal dealings with him from the past, which clouded things as well. So did he murder Ambassador Dokra, or was it as he said? Well, if we go with what Mbenga says in this episode now, he did murder him, and it was cold-blooded, and it was calculated, and it was, he saw the opportunity and killed him. That's what he tells this Klingon character, who turns out to be Ambassador Dokra's daughter, who is a very fascinating character who I want to talk about as well. But Mbenga, I don't know what to make of all this. Do we believe him then? Do we believe him now? Based on body language and the way he says things, I tend to believe him now. I think he did murder Ambassador Dokra, and I don't know how I feel about that.
Mbenga has been really changed. Like, we talk about how the Gorn have been changed by Strange New Worlds. Mbenga has been really changed from his initial, you know, characterization in TOS. He's a very deep well, I find. Mm-hmm. And he's acted so well in that respect, yeah. Right?
Like, Babs is incredible in this.
Man, what a, like, I would say, personal opinion, probably the most talented, like, just for raw acting talent, he has that. Like, there's something behind his eyes when he, like, stares, and he's almost looking right through the person. Yeah. Even when he's being, like, a caring doctor, there's just something. He manages to just carry this tension in him. So, yeah, when this gets revealed, it's not that I was surprised, but it still was a bit of a shock, I guess. It's the idea that, like, no, I wouldn't put that past Mbenga, given what he's actually capable of. Mm-hmm. I guess it just seeking that vigilante justice. You know, how do you manage the enemy when now you're no longer in a position of active and open combat? I mean, I hate to beat my usual dead horse, and I think a lot of Star Trek podcasts do this. DS9 did it better with Duet. I don't know. It's good. It opens up a lot more. And again, like we had mentioned about, like, how do we square the circle with the Gorn and their attack versus how they're supposed to attack or why they attack and all this sort of stuff. Now we've kind of reopened a wound here with M'Benga that seemed not necessarily resolved, but it seemed like we knew what was going on. And now I'm the jury's out. I'm not sure. Mm. I'm not sure what to think of this guy. And yeah, Pike's reaction, problematic.
There's a lot going on there. I mean, they are old friends. They've known each other for years and years and years, which almost, I don't know, like if I was confronted with this, that would almost make me react more than if this was just a colleague that I'd known for a couple years, right? So yeah, Pike, in that first episode way back when, he confronted M'Benga and says, you know, tell me what happened. And M'Benga says it was self-defense, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, okay, I believe you. And then in this episode, in the fight with Dakra's daughter, M'Benga says it was not self-defense. I killed the guy, blah, 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 blah. It feels very genuine. It feels real. Pike seems like he has blinders on, right? At the end when he's talking with him and basically says something along the lines of like, well, I wish I'd known sooner. And then lets it go. Like, to me, regardless of how you feel about the actual act, what M'Benga did, to me, if I have an old friend like that, the betrayal would be the not telling me, to lying to my face.
And then holding that for a very long time.
Exactly. Yeah. That to me would engender a lot more reaction, I think. However, in this one, and I think they both know they're both lying to each other, where Pike says, well, what I heard was somebody saying whatever they needed to say to get out of that situation. And was that right? And M'Benga's like, yes. Okay, cool. No, like, you know, they're both at this point, it's built upon this house of cards that, like,
and they're all get out of jail free cards.
Yeah. And it's just so. This is what I was kind of wanting to talk about with regards to Pike. He's held up as this paragon of virtue, right? We have the Christopher Pike Medal of Valor in Deep Space Nine, and mm-hmm. and everything we've always known about him is this legendary, amazing, virtuous person. Now, this is something Star Trek has done before, which I really like, is you take that myth and you deconstruct it, right? Zephyr mm-hmm. Cochrane, don't try to be a great man, just be a man, let history make its own judgments and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Very good advice.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're kind of learning there's a lot more kind of rough edges or slippery slopes that Pike is perfectly comfortable sliding down than you would assume given the legend around him, right? Which I think is a good lesson. But there's another thing in this episode in particular as well. Maybe we want to compare and contrast Pike and Una's command styles, and I mm-hmm. don't think Pike comes across very good in that.
So before we do that, I want to, I don't know if this is a counterpoint, but I just think of, okay, who are our beloved captains, right? I'm going to go straight to Sisko, and Sisko as well did some pretty horrific stuff, right? Mm-hmm. He cold-bloodedly murdered a Romulan dignitary to get the Romulans into the Dominion War. He low-key destroyed an entire planet to get one up on a crew member who betrayed him, right?
You betrayed the Maquis, your uniform. Did it first.
What's that?
The Maquis did it first.
yeah. I guess, but that's the thing is.
But yeah,
is,
no, I'm being facetious. Absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, I mean, this isn't necessarily outside of what sometimes our beloved captains will get up to. I guess, yeah, this one, I don't know, maybe it's Avery Brooks's acting or something. This one just doesn't hit as well. I think you and I both called this one out pretty fast, of because its contrast is literally later in the episode. So if we make that comparison, I think that's the important piece, because I think, you know, nothing is there by accident. I think the writers put this in exchange between Ortegas and Yuna for that exact purpose, to show, like, maybe there are some cracks here.
And I would say, and we'll talk more about it for sure. For me, it's Pike's passivity is something that kind of keeps coming up, where, and by the way, I absolutely agree. I think all of our heroes are very flawed. And I think that's part of what Star Trek has always done. That's kind of the point I was trying to make, was, you know, they are our heroes, but they are flawed for sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we got a little tiny bit of Pike way at the beginning of all of Star Trek, and then we just hear about him later. So
yeah,
it's kind of the inverse of Kirk, basically, where we saw his early adventures and then we got the overinflated legend of him later. Pike was different. We got the overinflated legend of him, and now we're getting the backfill, which is an interesting dynamic.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
As always, Positively Trek is brought to you by its Patreon supporters, including Joyce Mirren, Brandy Jackala, Christina DeClercq-Zalagi, John Guppy, Out of Memory, Patrick Carlin, and Ricky Long. If you'd like to support the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can join at any level and enjoy early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, episode shoutouts, executive producer credits, and more. Again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you so much to those of you supporting us. We truly do appreciate it. And now, back to the show. Let's talk about the Z word if you live in Canada, or the Z word if you live in the US.
Yeah. I'm impressed,
actually. I kind of am too. Star Trek does zombies. And yep. Again, they've done them in the past, but a little bit more directly called out here.
Literally, Pike says the name. Do you mean zombies? Right? Like,
okay, yeah. So I got to relate a little anecdote when you and I were watching this episode, and, you know, we see these creatures attacking them and stuff, and they haven't said anything yet. And I was literally in the middle of saying, I said, you know, it drives me nuts in modern media where there's like a zombie-like thing, but no one will call them out as such, because, like, you know, in The Walking Dead, they're walkers. In you know, The Last of Us, they're something else, whatever. Mushrooms. It's like, yeah, it's like the word zombie doesn't exist in popular culture in the universe. And then like, that is the moment when Pike said, are these like zombies? And then Big is like, don't say that. I was like, oh my God, thank you so much.
And again, I think this is where I'm gonna credit the writers. I think they were expecting some of us to begin the rant, being like, oh, here we go, they're gonna call them flower heads or something, or whatever. And then no, Pike just, and I guess there's a, it's not, the irreverence is the wrong word, and this time I'm not gonna like struggle over a word like I did last time, indefactable. But this ability to just call it for what it is, I think was actually quite enjoyable. And that's why I would kind of refer to this episode as a bit of a snack. Like, they never have to go back to this planet, really, if they don't want to. But now we've got zombies. We can play with that. And like, where's Sinequa Martin Green when you need her, right?
Yeah.
Of obviously Discovery, but originally, or at least right before Discovery, of Walking Dead fame. I'm sure if she watches this, she'd be like, I could have been there. I could have helped.
Yeah. I kind of made the joke when we watched this, that if this had been a Discovery episode, they would have had that cutesy line where they see them and she's like, oh, not again. Yeah. And somebody says, what? Never mind, long story. And then they just move on. But no, I honestly went into this thinking, like, oh, I don't know about zombies. Ugh, this is a bit much. But you know what? By the end of this episode, we had all this zombie imagery mixed with Star Trek imagery. And like, mm-hmm. there's two things that I will directly call out. First of all, is our heroes surrounded by force fields and zombies kind of like walking into them, trying to get at them. That's an image I did not know that I needed in my life. Like, that was great. And then the other one, which is a little bit gruesome, but you know, there's one of these zombies basically attacking Mbenga, and he's trying to hold him back. And all of a sudden, a Klingon duck tag emerges from the zombie's mouth because Pike has got him from behind. That was cool. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You've got Star Trek in my zombies, and you got zombies in my Star Trek, and it's like Reese's peanut butter cups. It's delicious. I love it.
Yeah, that's a visual, a zombie Reese's peanut butter cup. I'm not sure what to think about that. I think you'd probably find one of those in a university frat house between the cushions of a couch. Anyways, that visual aside, I've been pretty bored of the zombie genre. I really hit it hard when I was living in England, actually. So I watched like Rec, the original, I think it was Spanish. I can't remember. I watched, you know, Shaun of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead. Actually, I really enjoyed the original Night of the Living Dead. And of course, you know, sort of Cold War tropes there too, right? The zombie hordes were communists, right? Originally, that was the whole one of the ways to kind of parse this out, and so that kind of works in the sense. But I feel like this was done again tastefully, in the sense that this is a self-contained episode, and that's why I keep referring to it as a snack, because you know they don't have to ever return to the planet. We know the zombies are there. We can return to it if we need, or if we want, or if they have some ideas that they want to continue with it. But this was just like with The Walking Dead or any other zombie movie, you find out very quickly that it's not about the zombies. It's about the interrelationship between the characters. And I think this is maybe a good sort of foray into Ambassador Dukra's daughter, why she's there. She's not enforcing border control by any stretch of the imagination, right? She's here to kind of settle a score, but not even the one we thought, eh?
Yeah, so she's been tracking Mbenga basically this whole time, so she kind of could have popped up at any moment. She's been following him basically, and sees this as her opportunity to get him, right? She needs to kill him to restore her family's honor, basically. Now, this isn't, it takes a little bit of a twist, because she hated her father as well. Her father was a dishonorable man, and that is actually the reason why the family has been dishonored. It was because of his actions, and she was supposed to kill him, but because Mbenga did, now that's been taken away from her. So the only way to restore this honor is to kill Mbenga now. Again, maybe showing the knock-on effects, the generational trauma that war creates, right? This disruption. So she was a very interesting character, and I think an honorable Klingon in the true sense of it, not just paying lip service to the word as we sometimes get in Klingon politics and their scheming and stuff. She sacrifices herself to save Mbenga and Pike at the end, thereby restoring her own honor. And, you know, Pike even says, Pike doesn't get it. Pike says, like, no one's going to know. She's going to die. And Mbenga says, she'll know. And we know. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's it. That'll get her to Stovokor. That'll do it, you know, like, restoring her honor in that moment. And I really love this character, and I'm kind of sad to see her go. She's pretty badass, both philosophically and just physically. Like, when she takes out that whip and starts whipping the zombies and shooting them with her other hand with the disruptor. Dang, she cool.
Yeah, she is really cool. And yeah, there's a depth and a texture, right? It isn't that she's getting revenge for her father. It's, that little twist gives her a whole other dimension. Despite her not liking or, you know, wanting to kill Mbenga, again, we get a certain level of respect that she shows for him in that regard. And I feel like the fight was really good between the two of them, really well choreographed. Mbenga's takedown was really cool of her. And, you know, refusal to kill, that sort of thing. And yeah, and she does get her honor back. And I think it's important to understand, you know, from a Klingon's perspective, that's what they want. And yeah, how could a human totally understand? And Mbenga knows his enemy, right? To the point that he understands exactly what she's doing and why she's doing it, you know. She was the ideal, I think, Worf strived for in a lot of ways. Like the real ideal, right?
Yeah.
And only the good die young.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It would be great to see more of her, just because I thought the actor did a terrific job and she was a cool character. But, you know, as far as death scenes go, that was a pretty good one.
Full pull apart.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's pop back over to the Enterprise, because while all of this is going on, of course, they're late checking in. They're not returning to the Enterprise right away. So now the Enterprise has to violate the border agreement to try and rescue them. And yeah, there's this, basically they can go in at like 1/8 impulse or whatever it is, really slow, and evade detection that way. Ortegas doesn't like that. And her plan is to warp the Enterprise right into the planetary atmosphere, beam them out and warp away again. A plan that's considered too risky, and she obviously bristles at that. She doesn't like that. And of course, there's the events of the season premiere are still weighing heavily. She's suffering from PTSD. She's not herself, is I guess one way to put it. She's very much pushing against where she is and her norms and stuff, because she's going through this trauma and stuff. So yeah, she basically ignores an order and pushes the speed just a little bit too high. The Klingons detect the Enterprise, and now they have no choice but to do her plan, which is to warp in and do all that stuff. So yeah, this was hard to watch a little bit, just because I love the character so much, and you hate when people you love are kind of going down a bad path. I mean, this is, again, and I've said many times, why I would make a terrible Hollywood writer, because, you know, all of my characters that I love are precious and they'll never do anything wrong. And like, I just want them to have a very good day. That's not dramatic.
Yeah, no, I mean, trauma does that though, right? I mean, I think people who aren't experiencing trauma or can't recognize their own trauma, when they see someone else exhibiting a trauma response, they can take it personally, or they won't be able to see it through that person's eyes. I mean, what I really think of is Ortegas was the only person who could have gotten that boarding party out of the Gorn ship. She was the only one. And therefore, you know, and I fly the ship, right? She sacrificed herself. I think she was still mentally on that Gorn ship while she was piloting the Enterprise. She was the only one. And that's a trauma response. And I think it can be difficult as an outsider to see that, but people will carry that. Like, if someone ever reacts to you based on trauma that they've experienced, you aren't you to them. You're the person who might have caused the trauma in their eyes, right? Like, they go into the mode that they were in that period of time. Yeah. So it's very psychologically explainable. It doesn't make it okay, I think, is the other piece of it. I think number one's response is far more leadership oriented. And still, even though I think you and I both were like, still kind of light in terms of how she managed it, I think she was much better at clearly getting the point across.
Yeah. No, I really appreciated Una's response to this and, like, basically taking her off duty for 2 weeks and assigning her to training, basically. I think that was entirely appropriate and good. Entirely. And again, very much in contrast to Pike's handling of Mbenga, which seems to be sweep it under the rug and stick your fingers in your ears and go la 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 la. I don't know. Like, I feel like Una comes across as a better commanding officer in this, at least in this situation. And that's something I've been noticing with Pike not just in this episode, but over a while, there's been a bit of a pattern with him being a little loosey-goosey, being a little bit soft with people, which is a command style, and it's one that I've appreciated. I like the dinners with the senior officers and stuff, but like something that we didn't bring up with the season premiere this year, there's a moment on the bridge where Mitchell has been doing the navigation for a while, and she puts her head in her hands and rubs her temples, and she's obviously exhausted, and Pike walks over and says, "Mitchell, call for relief. You're exhausted." And she says, "Well, respectfully, sir, no, I'm not leaving the bridge until we've rescued them."
Yeah.
And Pike's response is like, "Oh, all right, cool. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. You recognized the signs of severe fatigue in an officer. You gave them an order." And they're just like, "No, I'm not doing that." And your response is to be impressed by that.
Yeah,
I get it. I get that that's Hollywood shorthand for like, look at how brave and amazing these people are. But like, no, I'm sorry. That's unacceptable.
Well, that's the bad side of indefatigable. That's what I was trying to get at, right? When Pike was himself, I think, exhausted, and he had exhausted all these options and he's still going, right? I mean, sometimes you got to keep going. Sometimes you got to keep pushing. But I agree. I like your point that sometimes you have to kind of tell it like it is. And you know, I mean, we watched Master and Commander, right? What would Jack Aubrey have done, right? We don't have time for your hobbies, man, right? Yeah. Like, there are things, like, we still have a job to do. And if you can't do that job, or you're going to go rogue on me when we're trying to do that job, you know, it's made very clear, going back to Ortegas, that Pike and Mbenga would have made it off the planet, and they would have been able to get things figured out. They just needed to be a little more patient, and they needed to follow the command of what they were doing, right? And even though Ortegas still gets them out of the mess and stuff like that, I would consider that a massive near miss, and that is a write-upable, reprimandable offense, right? Like, I think a lot about, you know, how ships worked, you know, back in the day. And I always link it back to pirate ship structure, right? On a pirate ship, they're actually really democratic, anarchistically democratic in a lot of ways, where basically the entire crew had a say on everything. And things were shared quite openly. The only time the captain had, I guess you could say, dictatorial powers was during combat or a storm, right? When the lives of the crew were at stake, you had to listen to the captain. Yes, the captain 100% could get people's ideas, right? Again, going back to Master and Commander, when they have to chop the rigging free, losing the one guy, it's actually, I think, the quartermaster looking at Aubrey being like, "We got to cut this rope," right? And but Aubrey makes the call. Aubrey is the one who internalizes that call, right? And Ortegas was flagrantly out of order, like flagrantly. Absolutely. To the point that she endangered the entire crew, the mission, and could have sparked a war.
Mm-hmm.
She's lucky to have just been sent to training. She could have been court-martialed and sent to prison for that, like Tom Paris style.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, really, if you take, for example, the assault on Captain Georgiou out of the equation, how is what she did different from what Burnham did in that first episode of Discovery, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, she took the situation into her own hands and made the call for the ship, basically. She just did it in a little bit more furtive way and less in your face, right? Yeah. It was a very, very dangerous and absolutely.
There's no I in crew.
Definitely not. I love this story. First of all, like, let's just put it on the table. I love that Melissa Navia is getting some really cool stuff to do this season. Lots of depth. I just like, oh, I hate to see my characters suffer. And I'm, oh man. But I recognize it's good drama. Like, it needs to happen.
Well, and they're being forged, right? Like, you don't, like, they're going to make mistakes. They're going to, you know, do dumb crap, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's how learning happens. I think Ortegas is very self-assured in her ability to pilot, in her ability to show that level of control. But, you know, sometimes that can be your undoing, right? Sometimes your comfort in a situation will actually be the thing that puts you in danger, that puts you in a position, right? So going back to Mitchell, yeah, Mitchell should have been relieved. 100%. You're right. In actual protocol, and I have a buddy who's in the Canadian Navy. I'm sure he would agree that, like, you know, if you're bonking out on me, get off the bridge. You're of no use to me here, right? Yeah. That kind of dogged, no, I'll keep going. I mean, you know, save it for the legends and stuff, you know, back in the day. Take a rest, take a break, look out for yourself, right? You're no help to a team, weakest link kind of thing, right?
Yeah. And I know this isn't a television thing. This is like a real life thing, but like, as human beings are just machines. And if we're at reduced capacity, like, I'm sorry, there's some situations where, yeah, you can just maybe push through a little bit, but at some point the numbers are such that, like, swap me out for someone who's at 100% because I'm not right now. And I think that was a failure on Mitchell's part and a failure on Pike's part, and mostly Pike, because I can't help but wonder if, you know, there's kind of that cultural thing where if someone says, you know, like, oh, you know, you need to rest, you do that first thing. It's like, no, I'm okay. But you're kind of secretly hoping they'll go, no, I insist. I kind of wonder if Mitchell was like, no, respectfully, I'm going to stay at my post. Oh, okay. Ah, damn it. I really am tired. Like, I really thought he'd say, no, I insist. Go to your quarters. Yeah. Oh, thank God.
Well, and you know, I'm currently moving, right? And there have been some really long days where I've been sorting through boxes, carrying boxes, moving a lot of box work recently. And not the easiest tasks to complete. And actually, just the other day, I was thinking about you're in my conversation after we'd watched this episode. And I was like, okay, on to the next box. And I'm like, you know what? No, I'm going to stop. And I did. I stopped. I laid down and I fell asleep. I slept for like 45 minutes. Oh, and I think I really needed it. I mean, folks out there, take care of yourself. Make sure that you're giving yourself the ability to perform at more optimal levels after taking the recharge that you need. Do what you need to do to recharge in a healthy way, and then you can get back to it. But I think the West, especially, we're really obsessed with that grind culture, right? Yeah, and I really do see
side hustle and all of that stuff.
Yeah, and I think and going back to Pike, this entire side quest was Pike kind of grinding out, trying to save his partner, which, again, what you're willing to do for a person you love, of course, it's unconditional. But even Pike's choice to go to the planet with this whole Hail Mary throw style, like, you know, it did really put a lot at stake.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's it worth?
One thing we also get to is we get that confrontation at the end of the episode with Pike and Batelle about all of this, and I found that a very interesting conversation. Again, a bit of the deconstruction of Pike as a character, where, like, everything has to relate back to him, and he is the main character, I get it, but, like, Batelle didn't want to tell him all this because of how he would react and what he would do, and, like, there's that line that you really liked, and I can't remember. It was, I didn't want to have to deal with how the fact of my dying makes you feel, or something like that. So good. And very telling and very relatable, I think, too.
Well, yeah, and again, kind of the reason why is it really hit home. And I think in regards to, you know, my family member who is at a terminal phase of their life, the other family member taking care of them, I think has been very aware of trying to not make this death about themselves. They will go on living, right? Yeah. And they will take care of that person, but also they're not a doctor. They're not a nurse. They're a partner. They're the person who can give that comfort in the place, but they have been really doing well at exploring their boundaries. And I think that's really important, right? A funeral is for the living, but the act of dying is for the person who's dying. And you need to make sure that you are aware of that. And yeah, Pike kind of made it about himself, right? And maybe you can kind of even look to Ethan Peck, Spock, losing Chapel, right? He was blinded in a lot of ways. And I think to some degree, this fear of loss has blinded Pike as well.
Absolutely.
A lot of intersecting storylines in this. They've really hit their stride.
Like I said, it's one of those ones that it feels very of one thing, like kind of shallow, and then you dig just a little deeper and there's so much going on here.
A lot of depth to this snack episode, as I've called it.
Yeah.
Snacky definitely. Side quest.
Well, let's jump into some, or bring out the dead, very appropriate for this episode, some last little bits. So I was curious about that title, Shuttle to Kenfori, and this planet Kenfori. It turns out I looked it up. I just Googled Kenfori and Google connected it for me. Kenfori is the actor who plays the protagonist Peter in the 1978 Dawn of the Dead. Nice little tip of the hat there. Very beautiful. Zombies in Star Trek. We got to, you know, tip our hat to the source material. I like it. The visuals in this episode, my God, the visual effects were gorgeous. As much as Artegas was in the wrong, if she hadn't done what she did, we wouldn't have gotten that gorgeous shot of the Enterprise entering the atmosphere and starting to turn into a shooting star before warping away from the Klingons. Beautiful, beautiful stuff.
As the shot's going towards them.
Yeah.
Again, the visuals so far in this, in episode, you know, one and now three, the space stuff is really tasty. Very good. Very, very enjoyable to watch. Lots of dazzling effects and stuff. And again, not as fast paced as the JJ stuff, but I would say just as visually rich. I think there's a lot of visual richness to the way things were portrayed in the JJ verse. Storytelling came and went a little bit. But Strange New Worlds has made up for that quite well. They have compelling stories with compelling characters who are intersecting each other. And even if none of that's landing, I mean, watch it for the ships. Man, it's great. Yeah. I do enjoy it. And I love seeing those old Klingon, what are they? They're not warbirds.
Battle cruisers.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Katingas, right?
Or is D7, that D7, but yeah.
D7s, yeah. Yeah. I'm not as up and up on my Klingons.
There's a little bit of fuzziness there if one is the other or not.
Well, and the Romulans had similar ships for a while in TOS too, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last bring out your dead thing for this episode, the hairstyles. Una was rocking something very different. It's very severe, pulled back hair with kind of this crown, this braid crown.
Yeah.
Which, like, I wonder if because she's kind of being the stern commander in this episode, if that was kind of a choice to go with that theme. It was different. That's all I'm going to say. It was a very different look for her.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not one to necessarily critique hair too much, but I would agree with you. It looked a little funky, I guess is the best way. It almost looked like a halo to me, or like Ukrainian bread.
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It didn't quite land, but Rebecca Romijn can do what she wants with her hair. It's all good. Like,
absolutely. Nothing,
she's still nailing it really well as an actor, so keep it up. But better hair choices with other actors, I find. And I mean, Pike's Peak is still looking strong.
This is what I was going to get to, is everybody seems to be kind of doing some interesting things with their hair this season. You know, we get this from Una. We didn't mention it, but Uhura has really grown out her hair this season. I think the look is incredible. I love it. Interestingly enough, though, the premiere episode this season, she had to kind of match the hair to how it looked, that closely shorn style from last season.
Right.
And you can tell it. She still has that volume of hair. They've just somehow undertaken a gargantuan engineering project to, like, really conform it to her head, and there's a couple shots where you can tell like her head looks very large, and no, it's just this hair they've had to confine to kind of match last season's look, but all of these, of course, pale in comparison to the ever-growing Pike's Peak that we have on the Anson Mount's head, for sure.
I think he's going to start, like, brushing the lintels of some of the automatic doors as he's going through. It's getting, yeah. Is that considered a pompadour? I don't even know.
I'm not sure. Yeah, it's. I think it's its own thing at this point.
Yeah, it truly is.
Well, we, you know, no spoilers for next week's episode, but I think hair is going to be a big discussion of a lot of what's going on in the next episode as well for a lot of characters.
Costuming, and hair,
and a few whose hair is not usually a topic of discussion. So.
Brilliant stuff. Absolutely brilliant stuff. So I guess, like, I think this was a great side quest episode. I think it added new intrigue to some character development. It definitely showed some flaws in our characters. But one thing that I really enjoy, and it's not that this hasn't been done in the past since TOS, but TOS did have a lot of its kind of staple cosmic horror episodes, which was a really big thing in the 60s. And this takes it right back to its roots, right? I mean, I wouldn't necessarily put this outside of the wheelhouse of something similar happening to Kirk and the crew back in, you know, 69 or something like that, right?
Absolutely.
Maybe not zombies necessarily, because they were very much in their infancy, but
his brain is gone.
Right? Exactly. Or, you know, no kill eye, the Horta. Those sorts of things, you know, these scary creatures that are, you know, kind of monsters under the bed or in the closet or something like that.
Flying snot creatures that land on your back and make you become violent and murderous and suicidal, right? That was terrifying to me as a kid.
Yeah, there were some the salt vampire always got me. I don't know. I used to have this dream where I would come around the corner and it was just standing in the hallway of my you know, childhood home, and it was visceral to the point that I think Red Letter Media got the cast for its mask face, and they formed it and, you know, kind of portrayed it. And I was immediately taken back of, like, it's there it is down the hallway standing right in front of the pantry when I'm trying to go to the bathroom.
Blech.
Right. And I was just like, you know, so no, I appreciate that. I mean, we haven't, I would still consider the Borg to be the OG Star Trek zombies, the tech zombies.
And also the first time the word zombie does exist in the Star Trek universe before this too, because that's how Lily, who, those bionic zombies you were talking about? The Borg.
Borg.
Wow. Sounds Swedish.
Yeah. Oh man. Dude, the good poll. That was, yeah, no, there you go. This episode to me isn't quite as rewatchable, and maybe that's just kind of where I'm at with the zombie genre, but I was happy to see it. You know, good stuff. And there's, I would say, gooder to come.
Definitely. Well, yeah, this, again, for an episode that on first blush felt very one note, there's a symphony in here, and it's been a pleasure talking about it with you. Yeah. So I look forward to extending that conversation to our listeners and watchers in the comments of this video, and also in the Positively Trek discussion group on Facebook. So please chime in. What did you think of Shuttle to Confori? What are your thoughts on anything we've said? Let us know. We love to hear people's thoughts and opinions. So thank you all so much for joining us this week. Next week, we are back with a Space Adventure Hour. I'm looking forward to that discussion. So, until then, as always, stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.